welcome to Tour Guide Tell All, the podcast where we explore some of the saltier, more interesting figures in American history. I'm Becca.
I'm Rebecca.
We're the Rebeccas. And we are your hosts for this evening. We're doing something special for the month of May. Rebecca, you want to tell our listeners what's happening?
Yes. So for the month of May, May 8th is the 75th anniversary of VE Day, which is the victory in Europe, the end of the Second World War in Europe. And when this all started, this whole quarantine business, one of the things that really struck me, sort of a sad note, is that we're going to have the 75th anniversary of the end of the war, and we're not going to be able to celebrate it because we're all quarantined in our home. And the 75th is really the last one we're going to have veterans really as a presence at these events. So it's the last sort of big anniversary. And so we thought to sort of honor that, we would spend the month talking about different sites and people in Washington and having a month-long sort of project and series about the Second World War and people and places involved in that. And so this is part of that.
Absolutely. So all of our podcast episodes for the month of May are going to include topics that are related to World War II, not just our main episodes, but also our small mini episodes. So if you are a regular listener to the podcast, you'll probably start to notice a little bit of a World War II theme. So we have talked a little bit about spies during World War II, and our topic for tonight was a spy, although I think that his legacy today is less as a spy and more for what he's contributed around Washington, D.C. Tonight, we're talking about Sidney Dillon Ripley. Have you heard of Sidney Dillon Ripley?
To be honest, before you mentioned him, I had heard of him in regards to the Smithsonian. I had no idea sort of how influential he was, not only in the Smithsonian, but I also didn't know any of the spy stuff either. But he's a terrifically interesting guy, and since I've had a chance to do a little research.
Well, he's a very good spy because you didn't know that he was one.
It's true.
Yeah, so I think if you walk around D.C., especially down on the mall, you might see the name Ripley on some buildings. You might see it come up for endowments and things for different positions at the Smithsonian. But I don't think he's a name that the average kind of Washingtonian today knows. But his impact is really incredible. He really shaped, I think, the Smithsonian Institution as we know it today. But to go back before the Smithsonian, he is a man who comes from a pretty well-to-do background, as a lot of these spies from this era were sort of privileged and well-connected. He went to boarding school. He went to Yale, which will be pretty important later into his life. He was really well-traveled as a young man. He actually almost died multiple times before he was like 13. One time he got malaria while traveling in India. Another time he went out onto the deck of a boat during a big storm and he almost got thrown off the side. But somehow he manages to survive all of these very first world privileged people problems from this era. And he graduates from Yale 1936. He considered being a lawyer initially. That was kind of what he thought he was going to be his path. His brother had kind of nudged him to be a lawyer. He was like, we could really use a lawyer in the family. You went to Yale. But he decided he wanted to pursue his passion, which was birds. I know nothing about birds, so I'm not going to talk on this podcast about his birding. But Sidney Dillon Ripley was like obsessed with birds, and it's going to play an important role in his entire life.
And the word I learned for this pod, Becca, is he was an ornithologist. That is the word I learned.
I can't say that. So Rebecca, anytime we need to say ornithology, that'll be on you.
Okay.
He will continue his education. He'll go get a degree in zoology at Columbia and then his PhD from Harvard. So this is a pretty credentialed young man. And he's finishing up graduate school right about the time that World War II is beginning. And he gets recruited by a man named William Donovan, who's better known.
as Wild Bill Donovan,
who was the creator, the founder of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. So because of Dylan's background, because of his connections, he gets recruited and he'll work under Donovan initially as a liaison with British officers. And then he'll actually be the head of American Intelligence Services in Southeast Asia. My favorite thing about this is he actually works very closely with Lord Mountbatten during this time. So if you're like me, you watch The Crown. That's Charles Dance.
That's super what I wanted to mention. I was like, he's friends with Lord Mountbatten. This is so cool.
And honestly, if you go back and read what Ripley wrote about his time in the OSS, it's a lot of him and Mountbatten sort of palling around, going to parties and being sort of ridiculous.
That does seem very on brand for Mountbatten. He was the Mountbatten, if you're familiar with The Crown, he's sort of Prince Philip's honorary father, his sort of uncle figure. He's very close to Prince Charles. But he also, before all of that, he was the Crown's sort of man in India. So you'll hear a reference that Mountbatten's the guy who lost India for Britain. And that's kind of what he did. He's the last viceroy of India before India becomes an independent country. So he's very, and he's very upper class. He's descended from Queen Victoria. And he's absolutely, it's just the idea of these two men like broing out in the midst of the Pacific War is just delightful.
I think this is also good context because when we talk a little bit about what Ripley will do with the Smithsonian, it's really surprising to me given that a lot of his formative years, his time in his 20s and 30s is spent with these very elite, exclusive one percenters. That's his sort of background. That said, you get a little idea about Ripley's personality. He really, really, really didn't like the nickname that was given to the OSS, the oh-so-social. He really didn't like that because he thought it made the OSS sound elitist. He thought it made it sound like it was a bunch of fraternity brothers, but also, like, it kind of was.
It kind of was. It was very much Bill Donovan recruited from people of his class, people who went to the Ivy Leagues.
There were, like, almost half of Ripley's Yale class ended up in the OSS or associated in some way. So that said, I love this sort of visual I have of Ripley. This actually comes from multiple men who knew him in the OSS, but they told this story of how he was once airlifted to meet a Thai king. This is all very, you know, in the midst of fighting, everything's really crazy. He's airlifted in, he jumps out of the plane, he's holding a machine gun, and he has a tuxedo in his backpack. So this was sort of the vibe of his
James
time
Bond
in the OSS.
Like, I'm just picturing, like, Pierce Brosnan circa 1990, like, with the tux and the machine gun. And also, if you haven't been parachuted in to meet with the Thai king, are you really living, you know?
I don't really know what being a spy entails, but I did not expect it to involve so many tuxedos in real life. The thing is, though, he's a spy, and he is working, and there were lots of questions about how long he stayed connected to a lot of his spy friends. But one of the things, or the reasons he's really interested in the OSS, is birding. Being in the OSS means he gets to travel, and it means he gets to see some really cool birds he wouldn't normally see in North America. So there's a great quote that comes from a man who served with Ripley. Traditionally, a spy uses birding as a cover for espionage and access to sensitive areas, but Ripley used his position as an intelligence officer as a cover for bird watching in restricted areas. So he really did, his entire time he's spying, he was keeping bird journals and collecting bird specimens while spying.
I also love, just like, let's pause on the image of this oh-so-sophisticated Yale and Harvard educated man in a tuxedo who's spying in the midst of a global war, and at the same time, really just all he wants to do is look at the exotic birds in Thailand and India. That's amazing.
There's an anecdote, which actually Lord Mountbatten would often share, about being at a party. Ripley is there, and all of a sudden he notices this green woodpecker and he goes running off after it, even though Ripley at this point was only wearing a towel around his waist. He found the green woodpecker. He caught it. He taxidermied it. And the specimen label read, "Shot at cocktail party. Towel fell off."
Can we also spare a moment to wonder why he's at a cocktail party wearing only a towel? Like, what kind of cocktail cocktail parties are these?
A spy never tells. At the end of the day, there is a lot of question about maybe how much heavy espionage Ripley did. Donovan did once get his hands on some British notes about the American team, and one of the people on the British side said that Ripley was not that big of a deal. He was simply a gilded bird hunter. So I feel like his motivation for being in the OSS was really around getting into his birds. One good thing that he does get out of his time in the OSS, though, is he's going to meet his wife, Mary Livingston, who will go on to be Mary Livingston Ripley. She's a Livingston like the Livingstons of New York, like governor of New York, signer of the Declaration.
Yes, I was going to say like the guy who signed the Declaration of Independence.
Like the Livingston. So she comes from a very sophisticated background. She comes from a very privileged background. But with World War II, like a lot of young women wanting to serve her country, she would get kind of recruited to clerk. She was roommates with Julia McWilliams, who we know better today under a different name.
Julia McWilliams, right around the same time that her roommate meets Dylan Ripley, Julia McWilliams meets another OSS operative named Paul Child, and she becomes Julia Child.
And the Childs and the Ripleys will actually stay friends for quite a long time. Ripley will be sort of influential in trying to acquire some of Julia Child's belongings for the Smithsonian later on. So they stay friends for quite a long time. So if nothing else, he comes out of the war with a wife. Now, post-war, he's a very intelligent man. He's a very respected scholar in the study of birds, ornithology, as it were. He's going to be a Fulbright Fellow, Guggenheim Fellow, all this good stuff. He's going to teach at Yale for like 20 years. He's director of the Peabody Museum, and he's a conservationist. So he's really ahead of the time when it comes to conservation. He's really advocating for understanding how much the natural world is changing, how much development is impacting the natural world. And he writes in the 50s that he's worried about these trends that show 75% of living species would be heading towards extinction in 25 years if man didn't take steps to try to conserve these spaces. So he's really, I think, ahead of the curve in that regard. So 1964, pretty big time in our country, right? Big sea change in the nation. And Dylan Ripley, this really dedicated academic, this bird enthusiast, and maybe still somewhat connected to the spy world gentleman, is asked to become the 8th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Now, a lot of people are pleased. Up to this point, the Smithsonian has really seen itself as a scientific institution, a research center, and so he's got the academic credentials for that. But there are some people who are not so sure. A lot of people see him as just a ne'er-do-well. They see him as kind of this man living the high life who only cares about his birds and nothing else. So he's a bit of an odd choice. And some people figure he's just going to be the same old, same old. And he gets this job, and he is ready to shake things up. He comes into the Smithsonian. It takes him 6 weeks to accept the job. He thought really long and hard about whether he wanted this job. And he comes in and he decides this is not a dusty attic. This is not just some place where we hold on to the treasures of our history and no one sees them. This is a museum for the people of this country. He says, I want to awaken all Americans to the fact that the Smithsonian belonged to them, not a bunch of curmudgeons on Capitol Hill. Which doesn't sound so controversial today, but in 1964, this was really wild. The prevailing kind of knowledge at that time, the prevailing attitude, was that museums were for academics, they were for researchers, and they were for people rich enough to have collections of their own. That middle class, lower class people weren't smart enough to appreciate museums, or that why show them the Mona Lisa? Because they're not going to get it, which is basically what people were writing in the 1960s. Like, you can lead the lower classes to the Mona Lisa, but would they understand it? So Smithsonian had really prided itself on all this research, but it hadn't figured out how to translate that to the average person. So Dylan Ripley comes in. He's like ready to get this going. So he starts doing things to reach out to people. Some of these things are viewed a little skeptically. One of the first things he does is restore a 1920s carousel and put it out on the National Mall. Now, I've seen this carousel. carousel's amazing. I can tell you many a friend of mine with kids loves this carousel, but people lost their mind when the carousel opened. They thought it was so undignified to have people riding a carousel outside of this important institution.
That makes me so sad. Having grown up, right, like, with a carousel, like, in the next town over, which was, like, a historic carousel, like, I love the idea that people are coming to the National Mall and going, you know, taking their little kids to something that's so, it's a fabulous little carousel. It's really great.
Yeah, he was saying at this time that these museums are living places. Children of all ages should come here. They come to learn. They must learn because it's fun. They shouldn't be footsore and weary. So he really, for the first time, he's the first Smithsonian director to say, what about children? What about kids? What about families? And he really, really comes up against resistance. There was one sort of career Smithsonian administrator that Ripley called the abominable no man for his unwavering diligence in barring the door against innovation. So he has kind of a tough go of it early on, getting everybody on board. One of the first things he does, too, is he changes the statue of Joseph Henry. If you've ever been out on the National Mall, there's that beautiful red brick building. It's the Smithsonian Castle, the first Smithsonian Institution building. And out front is a statue of Joseph Henry, the first director of the Smithsonian. Up until 1964, Henry used to face the castle. So he was facing this building, looking at this important building. When Ripley gets in, he says, no, he should be looking out on the mall. He should be looking at all the people coming in, inviting the people in. So he basically digs up the statue and turns it around and has it replaced in a new position, which people hated. But I really liked it. I walk by that statue all the time, and I never knew it used to face the other way. So he's doing some things. He's starting to mix it up. He founds the Smithsonian Associates, which still exists today. Classes, lectures, workshops. It's a way to take all this cool research, bring it out to the people. He will definitely get some bad press in his time as director because he has some pretty controversial figures coming in and doing poetry classes and talking about political stuff. And occasionally he will sort of have to go out and be like, I didn't know that they were going to say that or do that. But he never canceled the program. He never pulled funding. So he saw that as a way to maybe integrate some more progressive thought into the institution.
And he also does something that's near and dear to the heart of, I think, every tour guide in Washington, which is he starts the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which is it isn't going to happen this year, unfortunately, but it happens every year. And the only thing that stinks about the Smithsonian Folklife Festival is the time of year that they have it. They always have it the end of June and beginning of July, right at the time of year when it's hottest and we all just want to be inside. But what it is they pick two or three different folk traditions from around the world, and they bring dancers and artisans and artwork, and they have interactive exhibits, and they have stuff for kids, and they food, and it's really this wonderful way to get people to look at different folk traditions that you otherwise would have no connection to. And they bring them onto the National Mall. And it's really just this incredibly cool festival that happens in Washington every summer.
Yeah, 1967 is the first Folklife Festival. Ripley doesn't throw a lot of money at the festival, but he does want something that shows value in celebrating at the time what was American kind of folk arts and traditions, then expanded to encompass world cultures as it continued on. I know it's like it's such a weird time of year because it's so hot and can be so humid, but he said one of his motivations was to give families something to do on these long summer days. You have all this time to fill. 1967, not everybody's sitting in air conditioning all day. So he wanted like this wholesome family event. The very first Folklife Festival had 450,000 people that came. Ripley said the best part was just watching people on the mall together, watching families, watching people interact. He said it reminded him that a museum, to be a museum in the best sense of the word, must live and breathe both within and without. This idea that a museum is bigger than just the four walls.
Yes.
And I love the Folklife Festival and the fact that even though it's changed and adapted to all sorts of different situations, that we have it every year, that we have this reason to come together. And it really does feel like the Smithsonian sort of opens its doors in a different way for the Folklife Festival. And I hope this summer, even though it may not happen in person, I think they're going to get creative and maybe do something fun and virtual.
I hope so. I really do. It's such a neat little experience on the mall to kind of check it out.
Another, I think, really important contribution to the Smithsonian that Ripley makes is he's going to be the reason we get the Hirshhorn Museum. So Joseph Henry, the very first secretary of the Smithsonian, first director, he included art in the scope of the Smithsonian's activities. But there was a problem after Joseph Henry, which is you had sort of this scientist after scientist after scientist filling this role. And art got really pushed out. Even though the Smithsonian had art, they didn't display it. It wasn't on display almost anywhere. There was just kind of this disconnect, and Ripley comes in, and he sort of notes, at least in his opinion, that there was no top quality modern art collection in D.C. Now, I think there are some places that would beg to disagree.
The National Gallery, but at the time, maybe?
The National Gallery, though, at the time wasn't collecting. It was their policy not to collect living artists, not to collect modern art, so things that were modern in the 1960s. And the Phillips collection, I think, is quite wonderful, but they felt that that was more of a personal collection, not a scholarly collection. So Ripley really, really wanted a top quality modern and contemporary art collection. And he found a sort of unlikely ally in LBJ, President Lyndon B. Johnson. When you think about Johnson, you might not think of him as the most cultural, sophisticated
guy. And certainly not someone who appreciates anything remotely modern. Like, Johnson just...
I just think, like, if I think of LBJ, I think of him looking at, like sculptures of men on horses and, like, desert landscapes.
Yeah, I feel like him being very... Like, LBJ had a lot of insecurity about the fact that he was not sophisticated. And he really... I mean, a guy like Ripley, who went to Harvard and Yale, would have instantly, like, triggered all of LBJ's, like, oh, I'm not good enough. So I feel like LBJ was the kind of guy who took other people's recommendations as far as what's cultural and what's good art and things. And I just don't... That blows my mind that he would be interested in modern art. I love that.
Well, and I think it really does come from he wants to fight poor Johnson, right? Following the Kennedys, following the sophistication that someone like Jackie Kennedy brought to the White House, particularly with arts outreach. So Ripley comes along. He perhaps can read Johnson's insecurity, and he allies with Johnson. He says, look, we as a country need a top-notch modern art museum in Washington, D.C., and Johnson wants to sort of fight against this perception that he's a rube, so he throws himself, like, wholeheartedly behind this. Ripley, through his kind of series of connected wealthy friends, learns that there's a man named John Hirshhorn who has a 6,000-piece collection of art, and he's basically offering it up to the Wright Museum. And Ripley is like, this is perfect because I've been looking for one collection from one rich guy that I can, like, take and make my own. So Ripley sends Lady Bird Johnson to John Hirshhorn personally. Lady Bird is charming and wonderful, right? Very, very well educated herself. All that Texas charm. She goes, meets with Hirshhorn. Hirshhorn's being, you know, everybody wants this art collection. There are people from the Tate come in. There's people from New York, all sorts of things. And she says, we're going to have a luncheon for you at the White House. No pressure, nothing to do with your art collection. I just want to have you and your wife and some of your friends come meet some of our friends at the White House. So the Hirshhorns come, and there's, like, Supreme Court justices and members of Congress and all the D.C. glitterati. And wouldn't you know it, just shortly after this, Hirshhorn agrees to donate his entire collection. He also agrees to give $1 million to help build the museum. And then Lyndon B. Johnson tells Ripley he will get the other $14 million that Ripley needs to make the Hirshhorn Museum a reality.
I feel like she used the trappings of the White House to make him a little lightheaded. And donate all of his art to Washington. That's outstanding.
Look, you know, I know, you know, these other museums in London, New York, Los Angeles, they could woo him with money. They could woo him with glitz and glamour. But nothing beats the White House.
Nothing beats the White House.
So with the appeal of the White House, they are able to ensnare John Hirshhorn, get the Hirshhorn Museum, and then later the Hirshhorn Sculpture Garden will be added. The Hirshhorns dedicated 1966. Ripley calls it a great moment in the cultural history of Washington, let alone the country, that we accepted modern art as a fulfillment of the art tradition. So Ripley, very forward thinking and wanting to put really new modern art at a time when our other big national museum, the National Gallery of Art, wasn't really filling that need. And I think that's really kind of ahead of his time. The other kind of contribution to the Smithsonian that I think is really significant and that I don't think we talk about enough as tour guides or historians is the Anacostia Community Museum.
Absolutely. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Ripley, of course, you know, he's coming in, he's looking at the Smithsonian, he's trying to do new things. But when he's in the museum or museums on a typical day, he's not seeing the community that makes up a vast majority of Washington, D.C. He's not seeing everyday people. Ripley said he worried that the marble palaces on the Mall attracted so few people who might be described as being from the depressed classes, people who were often Black, underfed intellectually, and seemed to have the most urgent need for cultural media in which to associate and learn something. So he decides, let's do like an experimental storefront museum. Let's put it in an African-American community. Let's make it free. Let's make it accessible and not scary and fun. And let's do this. Let's have a community museum. It doesn't have to be about national history. Let's make it about local history. This is the first of its kind to be federally funded. It's a very ahead of the curve. Ripley hoped that maybe someday cities all around the country would do this, implement community museums. So they acquired the Carver Theater in Anacostia. They chose the Anacostia neighborhood because of its rich history. That was the part of D.C. where Frederick Douglass had lived. It had had really deep roots in African-American community here in Washington, D.C. They did something which I think is so cool. They started a neighborhood advisory committee. So it was everyday members of the community who were on this committee. They met every week with Smithsonian staff, and they worked together to decide what was going to be displayed, what were the exhibits, what were the programs, and that's what they did every week, and the committee just kept growing and growing and growing until it was like 700 people technically on the committee, and they were like, okay, now we need a board of directors. But for the first few years, it really was, if you wanted, you could show up and say, I want this museum to talk about my grandfather. I want this museum to talk about the store that's been on the corner for 30 years and the family that runs it, and it was really driven by the people who lived there. The museum was officially dedicated 4,000 people attended the dedication ceremony. It has moved in 1987. It moved to its current location. And the Anacostia Community Museum today has expanded its scope to kind of all of African-American history, not just specific to Anacostia. But I think a really important sea change, right? The idea too for Ripley was that if they got comfortable going to their community museum, well, then maybe they'd want to come to the Mall. Maybe they'd want to come to the other museums. Maybe then they would feel comfortable to go to museums in other cities. The idea that people just know to go to a museum is sort of weird, right? Like if you come from a certain background or class, maybe you know that. But if you don't have a museum in your community, how would you know?
Right. And how would you know that these museums are for you as well? Like we can say that all we want to, but if you're not, if that's not something you experience on a close to home local level, that might not occur to you that, hey, these museums and the Smithsonian belong to me as well. So it's a good way to sort of feed people towards that.
Yeah, agreed. I love that idea so much. I don't think we have gotten to where we have great community museums in every community, but I see Ripley sort of, as somebody who had has had a background in museums myself, I see Ripley like so ahead of the curve. These are things that we'll start to talk about a lot more in the 80s, 90s, and even now in the 2000s, right? How do you get museums out to the people? How do you get them out? And he's talking about this stuff in the 1960s.
Yeah, that's one of the things that keeps striking me as well. Listening to this, I feel like he'd be really a big fan of the sort of modern museum take that museums need to be more interactive and that they need to sort of meet people where they are rather than expect people to come up towards it to whatever level a museum's at. And so you've got a lot of museums and the Smithsonian is doing this pretty well. They're trying to modernize and sort of revolutionize what they're doing. And they make a lot of infographics and they make a lot of video and things like that. Like the brand new fossil exhibit at the Natural History Museum will probably be right up his alley, something that really engages you rather than just sort of a static display.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned the National Museum of Natural History and the Fossil Hall, which just reopened last year, which I think is fantastic. He actually, Ripley, got into some trouble because one of the things he did in the 1970s was really push the Natural History Museum to update its exhibits. He thought the exhibits were very dusty, stayed they were behind the times with a lot of scientific research. So they did a brand new Dynamics of Evolution exhibit. And in 1979, there was actually a lawsuit because they were the first American science museum to actually explain in depth in a museum the steps of evolution, and people were really upset. There were challenges to that. There was this lawsuit, and Ripley defended the Smithsonian. He didn't take the exhibit down. He didn't backtrack. He said, this is where the science is. It's important for this information to be out in the public, and the public can synthesize it and work with it on their own. But as an institution, we have a responsibility to put the science out there. And I see that with the Fossil Hall today, with really addressing things like climate change, really addressing the role of evolution. So I think Ripley would absolutely love what the Smithsonian's doing today.
I agree. The evolution exhibit is still there. It's been updated since Ripley, I'm guessing, but it's still there and it's still really great.
Yeah, he's fascinating. There's kind of these two sides of Ripley in this time period. There's this guy, the one who in the late 1960s is training the security guards how to deal with protesters respectfully. He actually did a whole training where he portrayed the protester and went limp in their arms, kind of dead weight, to sort of help them learn how to be respectful of those who may come in. He fights against calls. People wanted to close the museums when there were riots and protests in 1969, and he refused to do so. And in fact, in November 15th, 1969, there was a huge protest down on the National Mall, a major peace demonstration. The cops show up. There's tear gas. There's confusion and crowding. He welcomed 81,000 people into what was the Museum of History and Technology, which is today the National Museum of American History. He let 81,000 people come in, get shelter, get out of the cold, get away from the tear gas and the police. He kept the cafeteria open so they could buy food. And so you've got this man who seems like really a man of the people, but Ripley did have that kind of sophisticated upbringing. So you also at the same time have what the press dubbed the monarch of the mall. This was a man who did not have a lot of qualms about spending taxpayer money. He was written up in the 1970s several times in the press for chartering a yacht at a cost of $4,000 a day or something really outrageous. He was going out for these massive meals on the Smithsonian's dime. He was, not too surprisingly, going on Smithsonian research trips that were really bird watching expeditions for himself. And then he was a guy who never missed a DC party. He loved the nightlife of DC. He and his wife had a townhouse on Embassy Row when he was at the Smithsonian. And so they were often seen with the glitterati, as it were. So you have this really compelling portrait, I think, of sort of this man of the people, this forward thinker, this progress man, social reformer. And then you also have a man who is more than happy to be wined, dined, and be part of the elite in DC. And I find it really just kind of just fascinating.
It's a great juxtaposition of the, you know, he's a man of the people. He wants to bring all this education to the people, but at the same time, like, super enjoys like his position at the top of the social heap. That's kind of an odd mix for somebody who's involved in like museum education.
Yeah. It's sort of the sort of thing now that I think it was hard for him to walk that line from 1964 to 1984, the 20 years that he is director of the Smithsonian. I think it'd be even harder today with the press attention, especially the spending. But even by the 1970s, there was a lot of questions being raised about the money that he was spending, the money that he was pushing Congress to allocate. For every, you know, $20 million he had for something amazing, you had to know that like probably $200,000 of that was going to something for him. There's a little bit of that kind of like a lot of do good, but maybe a little bit of do for me.
And you also get the really interesting thing I'm thinking is that, you know, I don't mean to stereotype here, but people who are into birds tend, I would imagine, not to be the most, you know, outgoing and social of people. They, you know, I would imagine there's a little, that's kind of a niche market, I suppose. And he seems to be very social, very interested, not, and he's not just, you know, an academic who's talking about his birds, but he's really interested in sort of getting the information out to people. He wants to engage on art as well as the natural world. He's really interested in community engagement. So it's not a a sort of natural fit for somebody who's an ornithologist.
Yeah. It's sort of fascinating because I think he certainly has the academic background. He's got the chops academically, but he's not stuffy the way that academics are. He's got this very niche, nerdy interest in the birds. And like, I mean, like I said, I can't talk too much about birds because I'm not an expert, but he writes books about them. He documents them. His wife will taxidermy the birds for him. Like, they have a whole bird thing, you know, so that's like, but he's not so into that he can't engage with the everyday person. So he's really got this, like you said, juxtaposition that I find really interesting. There is so much today, if you look at the Smithsonian, that we have because of Ripley. He founds the Smithsonian Magazine, which at the time seemed crazy. At this point in 1970, nobody is doing niche magazines anymore. It's all sort of general interest or news. But he says, look, we want to get this info, this great research, all the stuff we're doing out to people who can't come to the museum every day. The magazine still exists today. He starts putting the Smithsonian on TV. He starts working with producers and people in the industry to start putting Smithsonian objects onto TV shows. Now there's a Smithsonian channel. Smithsonian has a massive kind of TV presence, and he's the first to really do that. He's going to acquire the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum, which is in New York City, which is part of the Smithsonian. He is going to acquire the Renwick Gallery. He does it pretty smoothly. Once again, he just calls up LBJ and he's like, hey, you know, there's that really nice building right across from the White House, right next to Blair House, real nice. And it's up for sale. It's going to be up. And I think the Smithsonian should get it. And I just think it would be really convenient if you were entertaining a foreign dignitary and they wanted to see some American art. Well, you would have to get into the motorcade, go down to the National Gallery of Art. That would be a pain. Wouldn't it just be better if you could walk across the street and show them American art? And LBJ was like, yeah, that would be convenient. And so thanks to Ripley, he gets Johnson to acquire the Renwick Gallery for the Smithsonian, which I think is just such a beautiful, incredible building. Ripley is going to be director of the Smithsonian when the National Air and Space Museum opens. This is probably, like, I think the one time Ripley maybe was a little off the mark. He was very supportive of completing the museum. The museum had dragged on and on and on. It had been stalled in fundraising, construction. Michael Collins, who had been part of the Apollo 11 mission, had been kind of tasked with bringing this museum to fruition. And Collins said the best thing about Ripley was Ripley just sort of got out of the way and let them finish. But Ripley did say to Collins that he thought it was a nice endeavor, that it was important for kids to understand flight and space, but he didn't think the museum would be very popular.
This just in, he was wrong about that. Super wrong. The Air and Space Museum is the most popular of the Smithsonian's. And in fact, in 2017 was the most popular museum on the planet, eclipsing even the Louvre. So he was very wrong. It is a fascinating museum, and unfortunately it's under construction right now and will be for the next couple of years, but it's really, really great.
So Ripley, I sort of, I was laughing reading through all this stuff and trying to, I knew 1976 was the National Air and Space Museum, and I was like, well, Ripley, it was obviously director. What did he have to say? And then you read this thing with Collins, and he was like, Ripley just kind of thought it was like a lark and that maybe it'd be good for little kids and they get a little idea about how flight works. And it is today like an impossible museum to get into. It's always packed.
It's super important and amazing.
Ripley would also start acquiring what I think are smaller but still really significant additions to the Smithsonian. That includes the National Museum of African Art. Again, Ripley is going to key in on one collector, acquire one sizable collection, also dupe that person into giving them money to help create this museum. He does the same thing with Arthur Sackler for the Sackler Gallery. So understanding that the Smithsonian Institution, while it should really be driving sort of representing the American spirit, American history, American innovation, and American character, For Ripley, the kind of quest, the purpose of the institution, right, the increase in diffusion of knowledge, to him that was global. And he thought it was really important that even during this 1960s, 1970s time, where there's such a focus on what does it mean to be an American, that the Smithsonian couldn't just zero in on American objects, that they needed to have art and information about other cultures and other places. So I think those are not always Smithsonian's other, I think a lot of people visit, but I think they're really, really interesting. And when all of this ends, I encourage you, if you haven't been to the Freer Sackler or you've not been to the African Art Museum, they're really cool and really interesting. He also is going to be the person who oversees the completion of the Enid Hopped Garden, which is one of my favorite spots on the National Mall. It's like a little oasis. You can just go and see the beautiful saucer magnolias in the spring, enjoy other plants that I cannot name because I'm a historian. But, you know, pretty plants. And this is not going to, I know it would not thrill a lot of you, but he is also the person who is going to spearhead the underground office complex, which today is the Ripley Center, which is named for him. And that's significant, too, because there was this driving need for more space for the administration of the Smithsonian, but it was important to him not to disrupt the beautiful views. And so he was very savvy with acquiring federal land, and he does so to sort of expand the museum, but also the administrative side. He knew it wouldn't be productive if a bulk of the Smithsonian employees and staff were working far away from the museums. They needed to be working as close to on-site as possible. Guy, he is not too surprisingly awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1985 by Reagan. So the year after he retires from the Smithsonian, he does get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He lived to be 87. He died in 2001. So he lived a really long life. I loved this quote from his last kind of letter to the Smithsonian Magazine, kind of reflecting on, you know, as he was leaving his job, like what it meant to him. He said, "To me, the Smithsonian has a hypnotic fashion. It seems to shed a glow over the mall that is both stimulating and reassuring. There is electricity, surprise, and sometimes shock. This excitement pervades the place."
It's true.
And I love that vision of the Smithsonian, because I think we are so fortunate normally in our day-to-day lives to get to spend a lot of time at the Smithsonian, to lead tours there, to bring students there. I often go in just between tours as a place to regroup and reflect and relax. And I love what Ripley's vision did for the Smithsonian. I think to make it the kind of place that we want to go to, the kind of place that you want to bring visitors to. Today, I always tell my visitors, like when we're on tour, you know, there's something for everybody at the Smithsonian. Even if you don't think of yourself as a museum person, there's something for you somewhere. And I really think Ripley like embodied that, and he brought it to life at the museum.
I think so. People ask about the Smithsonian's literally on every tour. And there's a couple of things that I say. And the first thing I say, that other than myself, the Smithsonians are the most delightful thing in Washington, D.C. And I am a huge cheerleader for them. I can't recommend them highly enough. But my favorite statistic, and I do deploy this on tour as well, that all the Smithsonians, and there are today 20 museums, not all in Washington, and they're not all even on the mall, but they are all free. And at any one time, all 20 of the Smithsonians can only display 2% of their total collection. So 98% of the stuff they have, they don't even have room to show you, which just gives you a sense of, and these are not small. If you haven't been to Washington, these are not small buildings. They're massive. So it gives you a sense of the idea that the Smithsonians are very much America's attic, and that we sort of have these great collections that are part of our sort of national heritage and our history. And I feel like he sort of embodies the idea of that sort of ethic with the Smithsonian, that he really is instrumental in collecting a lot of the stuff and displaying it in a creative way. And I think that that's really cool.
There were a lot of questions. He took a Smithsonian expedition in the 1960s, which may or may not have been related to some of his OSS previous work. So there were a lot of questions raised about whether or not, and all kinds of rumors, that he was using this job as a cover to continue some espionage. So that is pure speculation that existed in the press in the 1960s, but it does amuse me to think of this debonair Birdman, who was not that great a spy by all accounts, but might have been a really good one and got this job simply to cover.
It's the perfect cover. I mean, you get to hobnob with really rich and important people. Like, this is, there's a reason that when you read spy stuff, they're all very sophisticated and they know a lot about art. What better place? You know, I mean, this is like the makings of a Dan Brown novel, I feel like, literally. You know, like, what better place for them than to be at the upper echelon of American cultural life?
I'll put you on the spot a little bit at the end of our episode, since I'm sure we will do episodes more about museums and such, yes, as we please. Go forward. But do you have a favorite object on display at the Smithsonian? One you really love to share with guests? One you really like to go check out yourself?
Oh, gosh. That's like asking
for a
favorite.
I think Ripley would want to know.
I think that's like asking for a favorite child, which I don't have either. I could probably do a favorite per museum. My favorite museum, so this surprises a lot of people. I love the Air and Space Museum. I'm a big, big cheerleader for it. I feel like Washington, you get a lot of history, and obviously we're historians, and so I'm very pro-history, but I feel like the Air and Space gives you like the an out for that. Like, there's, it's like an escape and you can think about something other than history, and it's really cool. I love at the Air and Space Museum a number of things, but I feel like my favorite has got to be Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Vega. It's this big red plane, and it is hers. That's not obviously the plane that she was flying at her death, because we haven't recovered that, but it's the plane that she becomes the first woman to fly across the Atlantic in, and it's bright red, and it's just super great. I feel like that's got to be my favorite in that museum.
That's such a great one.
What's your favorite?
Whew. Now I feel silly because yours was so like passionate and so good. I think it's hard. I obviously have favorites in each museum and I have favorites that change, but I get a lot of joy out of the Jim Henson Muppets collection at the National Museum of American History. I can get very emotional about other very significant parts of our history, and there's a lot of objects I would love to go in depth on, but I love when you go to the American History Museum that you'll see a different Muppet, and it might be Bert and Ernie, it might be Miss Piggy, it might be Kermit. I remember being there a few years ago with my now husband, but when we were dating, and the Count was on display, and it was the first time I'd ever seen the Count, and we were there, and there was this very nice young woman from Afghanistan, and we were taking pictures with the Count, and she was kind of watching us, and finally she was like, excuse me, do you know what he is the Count of?
Aww.
And we were like, he's the Count of Counting. But I love that. And it's always really fun for me, I think, especially with students, to say, hey, be sure to check out The Swedish Chef, or be sure to check out, Cookie Monster. I think it's just, it's so delightful to me. So that brings me, I think, just joy on a very pure level at the museum. But I love it. I love the way the Smithsonian's continuing to innovate. I think the current Secretary of the Smithsonian, Lonnie Bunch, who more recently spearheaded the National Museum of African American History and Culture, now that I've done all this reading about Ripley, now that I've learned so much about his legacy, I think Bunch is like a real successor to Ripley's spirit about opening up these museums, making them places for everyone, getting these museums out to the people, which in today's world means out online, virtually, through their phones, through their computers, through their apps. And I'm really excited to see what the Smithsonian does. It's a weird time right now, but I think with Bunch's leadership, with Ripley's vision, I think that they're going to weather this and come out even stronger. So if you're with the Smithsonian and listening to this, we love you guys and we love
so
what you do.
Much. We love
we
you
can't wait
so
to go
all
back.
The times. I love the Smithsonian. I was in the Natural History Museum earlier this year and I turned around and there was an object that literally was from my hometown, like literally my folk town I grew up in. It was amazing. Lonnie Bunch has been so great for the Smithsonian, and I miss them all so very much.
So when you come to DC, or I think the best connection to this episode is definitely the Smithsonian Museums, and be sure to check us out online because we do museum tours, and hopefully we'll be able to resume those when the museums reopen.
Yes. Yes, when you come to DC, check out the museums. Can't recommend them highly enough. And we give tours of them. So yeah, definitely check that out online. If you've got questions about Dylan Ripley or the Smithsonian or anything else in Washington, please feel free to shoot us an email or engage with us on Twitter at TourGuideTell. If you have questions about this episode or any of our others and you want to engage with us and talk to us, we would love to hear your thoughts about anything. This is such a fun project that we're doing with this podcast. You can support us on Patreon with at Tour Guide Tell All. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, whatever it is. It really helps us to get the word out about these podcasts. And we're super grateful, especially to all our Patreon subscribers who have been so really wonderful, sort of helping us out and getting the word out, as well as supporting us financially, which is really great. So we love doing these podcasts. We hope that you guys enjoy them, and please interact with us. It's kind of how we're getting through this sort of insane time.
Yes, we're so appreciative to all of our listeners, and we're really excited about May and our World War II commemoration.
The hashtag is WW275FTBF, free tours by foot.
Yes, you could follow along on our hashtag. We'll have posting on our social media channels. We'll be sharing some blog posts, some infographics, this podcast, and some videos about some World War II sites. So the next episode coming up, we're going to be wrapping up our World War II commemoration with a little military history. So if that interests you, be sure to become a patron and you'll get to listen early. So thank you for joining me, Rebecca, talk about Dylan
Ripley. This was super fun, Becca.
And thank you to all our great listeners.
Next time on Tour Guide Tell All, get a break from listening to us talk about World War II and hear from some of our new friends who lived it. Becca chats with three people who remember where they were on VE Day.
You know where I was, E Day?
Where?
I was in the city of Washington, D.C. The streets were so full of people, the buses could not run.